welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 125. And today, Dr. Alex McDonald, one of the Physicians Weekly's board members, and he's also a family and sports doctor at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. He's going to interview an expert on LGBTQT plus healthcare. And you'll probably learn something. Dr. Scott Nass, the person he's interviewing, is a board-certified family physician in California, where he serves as the regional medical director for ALADAID. It's a national value-based healthcare organization, and it supports independent primary care. Since 2019, he was a chief medical officer for the Transgender Community-Funded and led Transgender Health and Wellness Center in Palm Springs, Riverside, and San Diego, California. Additionally, he's the past president of GLMA, or the Health Professionals Advancing LGBTQ Equality, a national organization committed to ensuring health equity for all sexual and gender minority individuals. His areas of expertise and practice focus on including primary care, HIV, LGBTQ, health, and addiction medicine. One point I should probably repeat here, just for those of you who maybe missed the last episode, is starting in 2024, we're changing the cadence of these podcasts to every other week so that you know that and keep it in mind. Look forward to hearing from you next time. Enjoy listening.
Hello, Physicians Weekly listeners. Thank you so much for joining us again. I am excited to talk to our guest today, Dr. Scott Nass. I'm going to let him introduce himself, but he's done a lot of amazing work within the LGBTQ plus medical community and patient community. So, Dr. Nass, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. McDonald. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, again, I like having my guests introduce themselves. And so tell us who you are and what you do.
I am Scott Nass. I'm a family physician in the Palm Springs, California area, and I have been practicing broad spectrum family medicine for a number of years, but over that time found that there was a great need to begin focusing my care in the area of transgender health and gender health generally. And so I have recently transitioned to focusing my clinical work as chief medical officer for the Transgender Health and Wellness Center in Palm Springs, with offices also in Riverside and San Diego, California. Well, that's my clinical work primarily. I am also a big LGBTQ health advocate and have been working on the national and state scene for a number of years with organizations to make important changes for LGBTQ folks in the healthcare realm. I am past president of GLAMA, Health Professionals Advancing LGBTQ plus Equality, which formerly was the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association.
Great. So lots of both personal and professional hats you can speak from today. So I'm excited for this conversation. So let's start off by level setting and make sure we're all on the same page here. So can you explain, when we talk about LGBTQ plus community and patients, can you kind of describe who they are and what encompasses that term?
That's a little easier said than done sometimes, I think. Our idea of what it means to be a part of that group has been evolving over the years as folks mm-hmm. begin to identify in more and more different ways. And as we start to see more and more role models in the media, whether that's social media or actual TV characters and movie characters, we start to understand really truly how expansive sexual orientation and gender identity can be. Traditionally, we used LGBT to really stand for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. And that probably captured then and still does most folks who are a member of the larger community. But we've over the years added a number of other letters, Q for queer, genderqueer, queer in terms of sexual orientation. So that's a little fairly more encompassing as well. And then the plus to be inclusive, but we understand that not everyone will see themselves in a plus or if they don't see themselves in another letter. But a number of places you might see I for intersex. A lot of times intersex folks are excluded when we have conversations around LGBTQ plus health. So a lot of times highlighting their existence and their identities with the I. A can stand for asexual, aromantic. You'll see that added quite a bit as well now that more and more folks are more comfortable identifying coming out as asexual or aromantic. And then there's a number of other letters. P could be for pansexual, polyamorous, any number of things. And so it's always important to realize that when we are trying to be inclusive by using indications like plus, we may still be somewhat exclusive because we aren't deliberately intentionally naming someone. And so I think the convention will continue to evolve as we evolve our definitions and our understanding of what sexuality and gender identity really are.
Great. Thank you so much. Yes, could probably spend all day on that topic alone, but we want to try to move on here. Can you also help explain for folks listening the difference between sexuality versus gender identity versus sex? I think there's a lot of confusion out there amongst the public as well as healthcare workers. And I think sometimes understanding the difference in those three terms specifically can be really helpful.
Absolutely. That is a challenging conversation. And that's really the place to start when we're in, you know, medical school or other health profession schools, trying to understand where people are coming from. And identity is foundational to how we begin to describe ourselves, right? So knowing what sex we consider ourselves, what gender we consider ourselves, and who we're attracted to can be interrelated, but they can also be very different things. They are very mm-hmm. different things. Sexual orientation and gender identity. We have to be careful not to conflate those things for sure. So I think sexual orientation is maybe the easier of the easiest of those areas to discuss a little bit. Traditionally, it's been heterosexual and homosexual. Either you were attracted to the opposite sex or the same sex. Mm-hmm. Now that we know that sex is not binary necessarily, there isn't either or. So, same sex, right? That's pretty obvious, right? If the same sex as you, then you would be considered homosexual, and typically gay and lesbian are the words we would use for male and female if that's a person's identity. Heterosexual is sort of a traditional term, using the male and female binary, but really looking more broadly outside of that binary, if folks are bisexual, now it means rather than being attracted to male and female, which historically is what we understood that to be, now it's one's own sex and the another sex, where it's pansexual would be all of the sexes, including one's own. And so it's kind of broad, but again, who we're attracted to, definitely different than our sex and gender identity, but very much related. So I guess that's a little more complicated than I was trying to make it.
No worries.
So even, talking about this for years, and it's still a challenge to break down.
I feel better then when I have trouble explaining to people also.
Well, it's a sign of the times. Things are always changing. And I think the more you interact with younger people, especially, and I work with a lot of adolescents and young adults, and it's really fascinating that, new terms are coming out all the time and they're finding their way into the vernacular and the medical terminology now. So when it comes to sex, we historically have thought of biological sex, which is a term that I do stay away from because it is a politicizable term. Mm-hmm. But traditionally, when someone is born, they are raised up in the air, given to the parent and said, it's a boy, it's a girl, or we're not sure. We have to do some more things to figure it out.
Right.
Traditionally, so folks are, male or female appearing at birth or intersex or, some variation that doesn't quite appear to be specifically male or female. And as we grow, we start to understand more about ourselves and begin to identify in a various way, right? I knew early on that I was a boy, right? I was a boy. I never questioned that. I had the, my body parts fit. The clothes I wanted to wear were boy clothes. It just made sense to me. I never fought that. But a lot of folks didn't really have that same privilege and start to feel that they're not necessarily fitting into the binary. And so that's more of an identity they begin to develop that can then be compared to their physical traits and help us understand a little bit more about where they came from and where they want to be going. So again, not super easy to lay out there, but definitely it's not about body parts. It's not about what somebody says you are. It's really about what's internal. And that does, compare or contrast with how one looks on the outside.
The way that I've had it explained to me, and this is an overly simplified version, but I think it sort of maybe is a good starting place for some folks, is sexuality is who you're attracted to. Gender identity is in your head. Do you feel like a boy or a girl or neither or both? And then sex is sort of your anatomy between what's between your legs. And that's probably an overly simplified version. But that's sometimes how I start when people have questions or don't understand. Is that totally off base or is that helpful? The thing to start
from? I would say it's a very simple but generally accurate version. And if folks want to Google the gender unicorn, they'll be able to see that in a very visual, fun way. And I use that graphic to teach medical students and residents, actually.
Great. We'll have to add that to the show notes, gender unicorn. Well, let's shift gears a little bit here. Tell me about some of the challenges and the health challenges facing the LGBTQ+ community.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty big topic, I think. And one of the reasons that I got involved with LGBTQ health specifically as early as medical school, you know, really, I think the number one issue is that we aren't teaching about LGBTQ or the importance of recognizing someone's sexual orientation and gender identity as just, you know, a part of who they are, right? A part of just things we talk about, right? We talk about people's families and their jobs. And a lot of times, if we don't know sexual orientation or gender identity, or patients don't feel comfortable sharing those things, then we aren't able to have full conversations, especially in primary care. I want to treat the whole person. I want to know the whole person. And I want to, you know, build that relationship over the years. And so to me, that's a critical piece of knowing who's in their life and how they see themselves and how they want to, you know, identify out in the world. But we aren't really teaching that still a lot in medical schools or other health profession schools. And I think medical schools are trying, there are some that are trying really hard to get out there in the front of things, creating rotations for students, building it into their curriculum in a very intentional, affirming way, as opposed to, you know, when I was in med school 15 years ago, the only gay standardized patients we had also had HIV, right? And so it was a very slanted way of looking or learning about gay men's health, right? It was all in the context of infectious disease, which is certainly a very narrow way of looking at sexual orientation. So I think that's the biggest challenge, is we aren't really putting a lot of clinicians out there who have an understanding of the importance of that in terms of someone's identity and how that can impact their interest in engaging in care, their comfort engaging in care. And we know that looking across preventable conditions, something like breast cancer, lesbians or women who otherwise identify as sexual minority are much less likely to get screened for breast cancer. And when breast cancer is detected, it is more likely to be at an advanced stage. There's no reason for that. There's absolutely no reason for that, right? If we're using universal screening, every person with breast tissue coming into a practice should be getting screened at the right age. But that still happens because there is this, you know, there's some misconception about whether people need the same screenings if they're a sexual minority. With HPV screening, right? If they've never had sex with someone with a penis, then are they really at risk of having HPV on the cervix? Absolutely. Right. HPV is squirrely. And if you have a cervix, you should have the cervix screened. Absolutely. So I think there's some misunderstanding. And then really the biggest thing, though, with the stigma against LGBTQ folks in so much of the healthcare system, right? So many emergency departments, hospitals, you know, health systems have not really caught up to the idea that all of their staff members, from, you know, front office folks to back office folks to clinicians to everybody who comes in contact with patients, really needs to have an understanding of what it means to just treat someone with respect and in an affirming way, or even if you don't agree with someone's, you know, perception of themselves, you know, does that matter in the moment? No, your job is to take good care of folks, and you probably went into healthcare to make sure that people had a really good experience, you know, in the healthcare system. And so, you know, focusing on that, being more education around providing affirming care and just a better understanding of what it means. Do good customer service, I think, in the healthcare setting. So I think that's another challenge as well. And people are just really averse. You have one bad experience, right? You have a bad experience at a restaurant. You're not likely to go back to that restaurant anytime
soon. Right. Yeah, and I think that's such an important point of, we don't ask a lot of questions when people come in the front door, but we sometimes make assumptions based on the way somebody dresses or the way they look. Your comments there really dovetail into my next question, actually, is how can we sometimes break down the barriers? How can we kind of overcome some of the stigma that we all kind of bring with us, unfortunately, and create a more welcoming hospital environment for these patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great way for any health system or any organization or facility to be thinking about, you know, what they can do specifically. I think there's also some things on the patient side as well. But for organizations to be looking for, you know, there are plenty of models out there, right? There are plenty of places to go and see where there are LGBTQ health centers or transgender centers of excellence or, you know, whatever it may be, to see where folks are really holding themselves out as being welcoming. And there's, you know, a need for that in many communities because they're just, isn't this universal, you know, affirming care wherever they go. So I think leadership in these organizations, you know, need to be, you know, leading and finding educational opportunities and training for everybody at every level of the staff. I think folks who work in organizations who feel that they aren't doing as much as they can to provide a welcoming environment. And again, not doing anything different for folks who are LGBTQ than they would anybody else, but just respecting, you know, who they're married to, who they date, you know, how they see themselves, right? We do that every day when somebody comes in who looks different than us or lives in a different city than us or has a different job than us, right? We appreciate the differences and we go from there. So I think that's really important to lead, you know, from the top down or even, you know, from wherever you are in the organization, you know, lead around you and create change in your unit or your particular department. I think that as patients, as people in the community, there's a lot we can do to advocate. So we can engage with our local clinics or other organizations to really help them understand how much is out there. To in terms of training, there are the Healthcare Quality Index from HRC is a great way for hospitals to really even just on their own take a look at how well they're doing. Even if they don't want to participate, they can see some benchmark questions that their peers out there are answering and being scored on. And then as patients, I know this isn't the most fun thing to do, but to teach up to our providers a lot of times, right? When we're students in class, we teach up to our professors. And it's one of the things we have to do in the healthcare system sometimes, even if we have a condition maybe that our primary care clinician isn't that well-versed in, right? And having to help them understand a little bit about, you know, how we experience that in our lives. Mm-hmm. Or even if they are an expert, like still helping them understand like our particular experience with that. I think sexual orientation and gender identity can be the same thing. And to help them understand, especially if the provider is really affirming, if they're really helpful and really engaged, you know, showing that appreciation and saying, this is great. Like, how can I help you help your peers, help your colleagues come to where you are? Or if they want to learn more, like how can I, you know, teach the specific things about me, you know, to other people that I'm not seeing in this particular visit. So that's, you know, a heavy lift for a lot of folks. And there's a lot of trauma sometimes around that. And I don't want to encourage folks to just run out and start doing that in the community from the patient perspective. But if you are, you know, clinician seeing folks, you know, be open, be inquisitive, you know, listen, you know, all those, you know, active listening, repeat back to folks, really seek to understand and appreciate where they're coming from. I think that's the most important thing we can do individually.
When I first started caring for some LGBTQ patients, you know, I had done some, you know, training modules and spoke to some colleagues, but I was really fumbling through it and I really relied on my patients. And I said, hey, you know what? I'd like to ask a question. I apologize if this is not the right way, you know, or tell me how should I ask this question? And a lot of my patients actually taught me a huge amount, but it was sort of by me kind of asking them and not just relying on them to tell me that I was using the wrong term or not asking a question appropriately. So I think I would really, you know, be open to our patients and ask them. I think they want to teach us. And so by asking, we kind of open that door and help them be the teacher as opposed to just us teaching them about their health. One experience I had actually just, gosh, I think it was only a couple of weeks ago, I was in my office doing some notes. I had just seen a gay patient and the nurses were kind of like asking some questions about gender identity and orientation. And I could kind of hear them in the hallway being like, well, I don't understand. And so I actually just walked out and I said, oh, hey, here's the terms for identity, gender identity, sexuality. And I kind of gave them a little mini lesson right there in the hallway. And then I showed them on our Health Connector, what we call it, medical record. I showed them the tab, the SOGI tab, the sexual orientation, mm-hmm. gender identity tab, which can keep track of, you know, different anatomy or anatomical parts if someone goes through transgender transitioning. So I kind of helped educate a few of those people one at a time. And because I didn't want them just to sort of snicker amongst themselves and not understand. And so I think it's really behooves all of us to educate ourselves. And then when we see those teachable moments throughout the day, kind of take opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. You know, one-on-one is really the best way to talk about these things so that people have a safe environment to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And I think practicing humility like you do with patients is absolutely something I would recommend. Because the worst case scenario, I think, well, not the worst case, but a typical scenario would be if you use the wrong name or the name they don't prefer or go by, I mean, or the pronouns that they don't use, they may not correct you because they suddenly I have identified this as an unsafe space and there's fear that if they correct you, they may not get the care that they need that day, right? And not you particularly, but the clinician doing that. And so watch patients' body language. I think that's one of the things that with EHRs, we're a little less, you know, these days picking up on body language, but I'll do my best to watch folks. And anytime they look away, if they're looking at me or I see a grimace on the face, like what sexual orientation, gender identity or otherwise, right? If I'm just talking about sex, right? That's a topic that some people are very uncomfortable with. And as soon as I see that shift in comfort level with me, I'll say, oh, I'm sensing something here. What am I sensing? And just, you know, hope that they'll open up with me and say, you know what? I, you know, actually use my own pronouns. I wish you wouldn't have assumed that, right? I would hope folks would tell me that if I did make that mistake or did jump to a conclusion.
Yeah, that's a great point. What are some ways, are there some kind of advice you can give physicians on listening to this, how they can ask these questions, how they can ask gender or orientation or pronouns? Is there any tips or ways you recommend folks ask?
Yeah, I think lead by example. Hi, I'm Dr. Nats, I use he, him pronouns. Tell me about yourself or who am I meeting with today? Or tell me about everybody who's in the room today, right? If they brought somebody with them, and that gives them a chance to use their language to describe themselves, their names, and their language to describe their relationship with the other people in the room, right? And that husband, wife, partner, spouse, significant other, one of my boyfriends, whatever it may be, right? You're giving them the opportunity to use their language and inform you. So really open-ended questions all the time. If you have a SOGI module in the EHR, you know, being careful not to make assumptions or force people into the binary if it's not as broadly set up as it could be to where you're able to put in open-ended responses from folks. Like, don't pick the thing that matches the closest, right? And never tell a patient that's what you're doing. You know, that's, it's just not appropriate, right? You want to make sure that you're always honoring patient's language. And even if you can't click the right box or the radio button or whatever, you know, putting in your free text or in your own sticky note, wherever it may be, like information that's critical that people, when they look at that chart, they know who that is and can really start there when they're having conversations with the person.
Yeah. In our EHR, there's a SOGI tab, which is really pretty robust, which I you can put, you know, preferred names and pronouns and items in there. But there's also sort of like a little sticky note where you can just put private comments just for myself that no one else can see. And I'll often put in there little tidbits or pieces of information that help remind me so that I can not make the same mistake twice or so I can remember. So pieces like leaving little notes to yourself can be very helpful. Well, let's switch gears again here and talk more about sort of the science or lack thereof regarding treating some of these patients. So obviously we're all scientists. We make most of our decisions based on medical evidence and data, but there is a significant lack of data regarding LGBTQ plus care, particularly when it comes to, you know, screening measures and things like anal PAPs. And that's a question that I've had sometimes from my patients. And I said, well, I don't really know. If you practice receptive anal intercourse, you are at risk of HPV, but I don't know what the evidence shows us. And so maybe can you give us a mini lesson on what evidence we do have? And then also, how can we continue to build this evidence and make sure we're treating these patients based on data and science?
Yeah, it's really critical that we talk about this and have this conversation in an ongoing way, because just as it has been with folks being loath or resistant to getting health care, you know, having folks participate in clinical trials or other medical studies has been a challenge for LGBTQ plus folks for a couple of reasons. One, until very recently, nobody thought to ask those questions as part of enrollment in trials, right? So even when we find out that a cancer drug works really well for, I don't know, men over 50, white men over 50, well, what else might be different about those white men, right? Could we look at that even further and see if there's a differentiation between sexual orientation, for example, here? So we never weren't really asking those questions. And even if federal agents are doing their healthcare inventories or their national surveys, only fairly recently have they started to ask questions about sexual orientation and even more recently gender identity, and certainly not on a universal scale. So we really, even at the population level, when we're trying to look retrospectively or just sort of more broadly at the population level, it's really challenging to sort out in these data sets, you know, if there really are differences based on sexual orientation and or gender identity. COVID's a great example. A couple of states, including California and Pennsylvania, set out to collect COVID related information based, including sexual orientation, gender identity, to see if there were differences in a number of things, right, in terms of vaccination rates or healthcare outcomes if folks got COVID. And they both found very quickly that it was going to be more challenging than they thought, because how do you suddenly at the state level say you have to collect this data to organizations and municipalities and everybody else collecting this data who had no way of actually collecting that data, right? It was incredibly challenging. There is just not a universal way, as EHRs will say, you know, you're lucky that you have a fairly robust module, but very challenging, right? Even at the population level or at the clinic level, unless you have this built in. So even doing population level studies like that, but in the data that we did collect, we did see that folks who are LGBTQ plus were more likely to have worse outcomes from COVID because there's a higher smoking rate among folks who are in the LGBTQ plus community. There are higher rates of immunosuppressive conditions like HIV, unfortunately, you know, in the LGBTQ plus community overall. And so we are seeing that, but how to really surveil that and create intervention that directly address that for prevention and treatment efforts across the board, not just for COVID, but for other things, really, really remains a significant challenge. And then we do have questions like the one you raised, you know, who should be getting, you know, pap smears? Who really is more at risk? And we tend to focus on men who have sex with men, you know, typically gay men, bisexual men, or other identifying men who have sex with other men. But there's a little conjecture there. I'm not saying that to blame anyone, but it makes sense, right? It makes sense, right? Those folks are more likely to get HIV, so they might be more likely to have other infectious conditions or STIs or whatever you would call HPV. And so it makes sense, but the question is, if we did mass universal screening for that with anal paps for everybody who says, yes, I have receptive anal intercourse, like what kind of a difference are we going to make? And we haven't done that, right? There are places that are trying to, there are centers that are looking at it. And there are centers like New York and San Francisco and to a lesser extent Palm Springs that are really promoting that among those communities. Just, you know, hey, it's something we can do and try to head off. For somebody, we don't know what the cost benefit analysis fully is, but I think, you know, finding out that information in a larger study is critical. And for anything that disproportionately affects anyone within the LGBTQ plus community. But again, a lot of stigma still for folks coming into trials, unless they are in a center where they know that they feel welcome. They've had good experiences. There's a lot of good evidence coming out. Obviously, the Pride study out of San Francisco does a lot of work around this at the population health level. So anybody anywhere can take part in that, but it's not the same as doing a very specific clinical trial to really identify whether an intervention is impactful.
Yeah,
we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the key about screening in particular is once you find it, like, what do you do about it? And then also on a broad scale, does it actually, you know, improve morbidity, mortality? Exactly. I actually had a friend who's actually a urologist who had, he asked me because he didn't know, he had a transgender woman who was having prostate issues. And I guess their father had just been diagnosed with prostate cancer. And so they're like, what do I do? Like, there's no guidelines on how you treat or work up, you know, any potential prostate cancer in a transgender woman. So lots of questions,
yeah,
a lot of work to do. Well, so this has been amazing. Where can, you already mentioned the unicorn, where can physicians learn more information or get more information about how to better care for LGBTQ plus patients?
So I think there are more and more resources out there these days. Fortunately, there are so many local and regional conferences that are taking place around LGBTQ mm-hmm. health. You know, I'm very partial to GLAMA's educational offerings, having been a member of the board for a number of years and past president, as I mentioned before. And so GLAMA, GLMA.org for the annual conference and other information there. Also the National LGBTQIA Plus Health Education Center out of the Fenway Institute. And so that's going to be LGBTQIA Health Education.org. Has a lot of great free online modules. I would say that's a great place to start. Go there, poke around, like learn some things in a few minutes, right? They have 5-minute videos, from modules you can walk through. And then find folks in your own organizations who are experts, who are leading in this area, right? If you have somebody that patients are mentioning to you, or you hear through the grapevine, or just know that they're providing this kind of care, like, become their friend, you know, pal up with them and say, hey, teach me everything you know. I want to be as an affirming, knowledgeable clinician just like you.
Well, that is a phenomenal kind of list of resources there, and we could probably go on and on. Last question, and perhaps the most important question, what makes you most proud to be a family physician?
I love being a family physician. I'm from rural Kentucky originally and wanted to be that country doc for everybody. I found, though, when I got into med school and then residency, that family medicine can be anything, right? There's so much there. And I had such a struggle really figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. But I'm so proud that I can take care of patients in the hospital and meet them there and be their family doctor at the bedside and really help think about the before, during, and after of those experiences, that I can, you know, also be an HIV specialist and focus on, you know, gender health and really do deep dives with folks in these areas and really provide services that are so challenging for them to find and, you know, really treat patients at every moment in their life. I don't do OB right now, but other than that, really seeing folks from the time that they're, you know, able to talk and communicate with me to the time that they're on their way out of this life and just celebrate and share with them all along the way. So I really do appreciate family medicine for all that it is. And I'm so excited that I can be a family doctor every day.
Wonderful. So very well said. And you and I can start a support group for those with Peter Pan syndrome who don't want to grow up. I'm still trying to figure it out myself. So, Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Nass. Thank you for everyone out there listening. And we look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly. Physicians Weekly offers in-depth interviews with the most highly respected experts in the medical community. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.